it's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate, and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
I'm Christian Williams. I'm the author of Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America, and Fire the Cops, which is a collection of short pieces that I've written about policing. And I've been involved in the police accountability and police abolition movement for, I don't know, 25 years.
Awesome. And you've also written some other books. I mean, let's throw those out there, too. You wrote one about torture. We're also going to be talking about counterinsurgency. You have a book that you edited.
Yes, I was one of three editors on Life During Wartime, Resisting Counterinsurgency. Most recently, just this month, AK Press has released my book on Oscar Wilde and anarchism called Resist Everything Except Temptation, which I'm glad to finally be writing about something I like.
Which doesn't involve police, torture,
well, you know,
counterinsurgency.
They lock him in solitary confinement for 2 years.
Oh,
so
okay. Well,
I don't get put so far away.
Gotcha. Well, to go back to your book, Our Enemies in Blue, just to kind of like set the stage here, you know, that really traces the history of the police out of slave patrols in the American South. And since that book has been published, there's been a lot of other new books that have come out. I saw recently one that I think is 2 years old, but it's been mentioning more and more just with everything going on. A lot of people have pointed towards the higher degree in which African Americans and people of color are stopped by the police, especially in their cars, which of course leads to both money in the form of fines or traffic tickets, but also in the amount of interactions that people are having with police, which of course puts them in danger of either being, you know, injured or shot by the police or even killed. And I'm just curious, you know, looking at the information that's come out since the book has been published, how would you say this backs up your original analysis and also just shows that what we're living with right now is simply just a continuation of what police evolved out of then?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot the last couple weeks. Our Enemies in Blue, the first edition, came out in 2004, and there were several points in my argument that at the time were completely heretical and which have now become part of the mainstream discourse. And what one of those was, I mean, the theory that they evolved from slave patrols and not from the New England Town Watch was not original to me, but it was still kind of an outlier position at that point. And that's just more and more accepted by historians. Similarly, the argument I made, which at the time even I thought was a little bit crackpot, that militarization and community policing weren't divergent strategies, but were actually complementary aspects of a counterinsurgency program. Thanks to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, both military and police literature have now made that argument explicitly over and over again. And then most recently, I end the book by arguing that we're not going to reform our way out of our police problem and that we need to look to abolitionist solutions, which, at the time was, you know, there were even a lot of anarchists who didn't subscribe to that position at the time. And now that's like a debating point in mainstream discourse. And it's really pretty validating. In terms of the point that you raise about, you know, increasing amounts of evidence about the overrepresentation of people of color and black people in particular. Yeah. I mean, really, all of the evidence is in the same direction here, which is that people of color are vastly overrepresented at every stage of the criminal legal process. They're stopped more, they're searched more, they're hurt more. I mean, at a higher rate, not more numerically. They're more likely to go to prison. They, on average, serve longer terms for the same crimes. I mean, just across the board, it's that they are overrepresented in that system. And, you know, at some point that stops looking like an accident and starts looking like part of the design.
Yeah, just there was a really great Vice documentary that was put out a couple years ago called Driving While Black. And basically its whole point was that, you know, what you're speaking of, the overrepresentation or the high numbers of arrests and ticketing, like they were doing studies on African Americans in a predominantly African American community being pulled over by the police just repeatedly. And what this led to was, of course, people getting tickets to come to court, which, you know, even if you, you know, literally did nothing wrong, you would still have to pay a minimum court fee. So their argument was, is this essentially amounted to, you know, a poll tax on an already poor neighborhood that was already paying their share. And I just think it's interesting that if you go to, like, you know, the libertarian right or the kind of conspiratorial right that they're going to take away our guns or overtax us or do this or that, like, all of those kind of intrinsic white fears actually exist in reality, but they're playing out, you know, through policing on largely bodies of color.
Yeah, and, you know, there was a lot of scrutiny very briefly around the time of the Ferguson uprising on the use of policing as this sort of extractive, extortionist enterprise. Because one of the things that came out about the city of Ferguson in particular was that they were using the criminal legal system as this way of generating revenue for the local government, that they really relied on the process of citations and court fees and then, you know, penalties for late payments and all of that. And it's really startling how relatively modest fines can become these like life ruining expenses if you just don't happen to have a couple of $100 when you get the ticket. Like if you're a relatively well off person, you get a ticket, it's annoying and it's slightly expensive, but you write a check and you're done. But if you're poor and you get the ticket, then you end up in a payment plan, you end up paying on the interest before you ever pay on the, and often on fees just for being in the plan before you even get to the part where you start paying the actual ticket. And what was a, you know, $7,500, $200 ticket for like, you know, jaywalking or running stop sign or whatever it was, ends up costing you thousands of dollars. It's like, it's literally more expensive to be poor.
I mean, some local governments are depending on that money and actually balancing their budgets and passing things based on that. Well, let's move on to another book that we first brought up. You're the editor of a book on counterinsurgency, also referred to as COIN for short. Can you explain counterinsurgency for us? And especially because in the book, it's a collection of essays, and basically it talks about since, you know, the liberation struggles of the 60s and 70s, basically out of that grew a counterinsurgency practice that was both the militarization of the police and community policing. And also there was this interplay between kind of military operations overseas and also stuff that was happening in the U.S. And this also ties into kind of policing theories like broken windows and things like that. But just tell us, you know, how did we get to this point today? And how does kind of counterinsurgency play into police really viewing human communities as potential bases for insurgency?
Counterinsurgency is a particular theory on counter-revolutionary warfare, and it's based in the experience of the defeats of empires in the period of decolonization. In particular, I'm going to be relying on the work of a man named Frank Kitson, who was a British general who served in Aden, served in Cyprus, was responsible for the troops in Northern Ireland during the Bloody Sunday massacre. Really, you know, his history looks like a demon's resume, but he was one of the main theorists of this, in the 50s and early 1960s. And one of his insights was that the previous theory of how unrest developed, where, there were subversive elements that somehow corrupted the community and created this kind of temporary derangement that could then be eliminated simply by identifying the subversive elements and eliminating them. That was basically wrong. And that instead, in societies with vast inequality, there were just inherently going to be conflicts, and that the job of the state was not simply to identify, you know, the communists and round them up, but instead to manage that conflict. And that crucially, that meant that the coercive elements, while very important, were actually secondary to efforts that would build the government's legitimacy. And that, and one of the things that he observed in his history trying to hold the empire together was that the state always had the military advantage, and yet it lost in one conflict after another. And the reason for that was that the military conflict was actually secondary to the political conflict, and that the real struggle there was not simply for exercising military dominance, but for winning the loyalty of the population, gaining legitimacy. So in Vietnam, that famously got referred to as the battle for hearts and minds. And around the same time, there was, as the U.S. was busy pretending to win the Vietnam War, there was all this unrest domestically, which police commanders and to some degree military commanders were trying to come to grips with. And they applied many of the same strategies that were being field tested in Vietnam domestically. And important police leaders at the time, people like Daryl Gates, are completely open about this fact. Daryl Gates, who at the time was a commander in the Los Angeles Police Department and later became their much embattled police chief. And so things like the SWAT team, things like specialized riot training, the application of military training, the application of military structures, like platoon structures, the application of military weaponry, all of that came out of this period. But so also did the whole project of community policing, which is this effort to establish positive feeling about the cops in the community, to build social relationships between the police department and the community, and suddenly to shift community resources that would otherwise go to other kinds of programs into, like, to at least put it under the umbrella of law enforcement. And so to increasingly give the police a role in things like schools and things like community centers and youth programs and all that kind of stuff. And so the Neighborhood Watch, the police athletic league, the like midnight basketball, all that kind of stuff, is the officer friendly going to the schools, the DARE program, all of that comes out of this sort of philosophy that the police and the community create a partnership that provides stability. Of course, the police are always the senior partner. Interestingly, after Vietnam, the U.S. military largely gave up on counterinsurgency. I mean, they basically made it a specialized field and would send specialists to enact it in, you know, hotspots in Latin America. But in general, the military theory was about superior air power and just bombing cities into rubble. The police, however, really kept with this dual militarization and community policing approach, such that when the United States invaded Afghanistan and then Iraq and suddenly found itself fighting insurgencies again, the place that the U.S. military looked to relearn how to do counterinsurgency was American police departments. And so they would embed Marines with the Los Angeles Police Department's gang task force and to prepare them for going to Afghanistan, and military advisors started observing and advising domestic police forces in terms of especially anti-gang policing. And the circuit there between military engagement and domestic policing became very, very tight, and also completely validated my thesis from Our Enemies in Blue.
Yeah, fascinating. I mean, I really encourage people to, there's a couple texts in the It's Going Down library. You can actually see a PDF of the counterinsurgency book that we're talking about that's in there. Obviously, we also encourage you to buy it, but you can check it out there. And also, there's a really good PDF that's also in the library I would encourage people to read called The New State Repression. And I believe you have an introduction to that piece. And that really kind of serves as a really kind of classical kind of introduction to the idea of counterinsurgency, basically as that there is a, the state is essentially waging a counterinsurgency war that, that basically never ends, but it's designed to essentially stop a sort of rebellion or an uprising from happening. Basically, like, you know, we don't want to see another, you know, late 1960s to early 1970s happen again, and we're going to design society to such a degree in which it'll hopefully stop it before it happens. And that's kind of the idea of broken windows theory, the idea that, you know, a few broken windows might lead to a full-scale disorder, or that a couple tags on the subway signals to the, you know, rest of society that policing and the state have no control, and that, you know, that could lead to something else, which could then, at some point, you know, threaten the state's power, so on and so forth. Also ties into, I mean, a lot of people have, for instance, brought up broken windows in relation to, like, the police murder of people like Eric Garner. And also, too, I mean, I think that also ties into with George Floyd. I mean, kind of like, how did we get to a point where, you know, police are literally murdering people in the street over, you know, a $10 forged check or some guy selling loose cigarettes on the street?
So the broken windows theory gets its name and comes out of an article from the Atlantic Monthly in, if memory serves, 1982 by James Wilson and George Kelling. Kelling was still is a criminologist and advises police departments all over the country. Wilson was a conservative sociologist with some, let's say, archaic views on race. And they made this argument that very minor signs of disorder lead to major crime because they send signals that an area is uncared for. And their classic example of this was the broken window, that if one window in a building is broken and it doesn't get repaired, that sends the signal that nobody is caring for that building, and then soon other windows get broken. It has a certain intuitive plausibility, although there's actually not a lot of empirical evidence for this. And so scaling up from this relatively modest sort of thought experiment anecdote, they argue that if you want to prevent major crime, like, you know, armed robbery and rape and murder and drive-by shootings and whatever, what the police really should be doing is focusing on the small signs of disorder, things like jaywalking and drinking in public and those, you know, the things which in many places are not even technically criminal offenses, but are simply civic violations, meaning they're not usually jailable offenses. They're something you get a ticket for. And the truth is that society doesn't really work the way that they say it does, and that there's not very good evidence for thinking that really cracking down on littering is going to, like, I don't know, stop human trafficking or whatever. But what it does do is the focus on those very minor offenses, which people commit, like all people commit all the time, means that the police have license to use their discretion because they're not going to enforce it 100%. They absolutely, if you're focusing on the most minor offenses, then you're going to be enforcing the law selectively. And so that gave police license to use their discretion to stop, engage, search, run warrant checks on, all that sort of thing, whoever they decided to. And predictably, the people who got the brunt of this were people of color and very poor people. That is, in fact, baked into the theory. Like, if you read the Atlantic Monthly article, they expressly talk about this as a means of bringing police attention to homeless people. They expressly talk about how this will focus police attention on poor neighborhoods. They expressly talk about how the offenses that they're focusing attention to will disproportionately be committed by people who live more of their lives in public, which, you know, poor people often will be drinking in public, whereas better off people will be drinking indoors for the totally straightforward reason that the richer you are, the more indoors you have in which to do your drinking. So that class and race bias is just baked into the theory. And police took it and ran with it. Probably the most notable recent version of the place where it really took off was New York. And it, of course, was practically synonymous with Giuliani's reign during the 90s. But continued after that, and the stop and frisk program, which, you know, was declared unconstitutional a few years ago, but persists in other forms, was literally what it sounds like. Like the police would just stop and search people more like in theory at random, but it turned out random has a bias because the super majority of the people stopped and frisked over the life of that program were people of color, like far outstripping their portion of the population in New York City. And so the broken windows theory doesn't hold up in the sense of focusing on graffiti will prevent, I don't know, carjackings, but it does give the police this tool that they basically have license to shake down anybody that they care to. And predictably, the people that they care to shake down are the people who have the least power in society, especially poor people and people of color. And the net effect of that is that it really intensifies police attention to those particular communities and disrupts the normal course of social life in those communities. So, innocent things like teenagers hanging out in a park suddenly become a legitimized point of police interference, which makes it increasingly hard for sort of normal social life to happen, is destructive of the bonds that hold the community together, makes it difficult for anything like organizing or even anything like just sort of informal solidarity to take hold, because it largely puts the police in charge of everything that happens in public.
Also encourage people, if you're listening now, we have another episode that's about kind of the cross-pollination between technology companies that operate in the occupied territories in Palestine and kind of how they're feeding off of other technology that they're developing on the U.S.-Mexico border, which I think really ties into this discussion, which you'd find very interesting. But just continuing forward, I mean, if counterinsurgency has been this kind of, you know, specific mode of operation that the police have used since the 1970s, then how do we get to this gigantic uprising that we're seeing right now? I mean, obviously something didn't work. You know, why is that so, would you say?
Repression's hard. Like the Kitson's insight that in unequal societies that resistance was just inevitable, it like is a good insight. I mean, you know, it's not original to him, but he was maybe the first real theorist of repression who genuinely tried to come to terms with that. And it is very difficult for the state to maintain its legitimacy. And it's especially difficult for the state to maintain its legitimacy while pursuing other agendas that include making life worse for people at the bottom of the hierarchy. Because, you know, a lot of the way that other countries maintain their legitimacy is by doing a better job of providing services to people, right? They do a better job of educating the public. They do a better job of providing healthcare. They, you know, they put themselves in the position of giving people things that they need, which has a legitimizing effect, makes their authority seem valid. The U.S. government has, at least since Reagan, pursued a plan of making life worse for people of color and poor people, which has tended to erode the sense of loyalty and the sense that the government's rule was in any sense like rational or valid or natural. And it's very hard to pursue both of these agendas at the same time of making capitalism more exploitative, making providing less for the population in terms of state services, and making it seem like the social system that we have is somehow serving everyone's interests. The conflict becomes clearer as time goes on and things get worse.
Do you think that after this rebellion, the police will go back and do an evaluation of counterinsurgency strategy, or they will just double down? I mean, that seems to be kind of what they're doing. I mean, obviously the response to the rebellion is, smash people with as much force as possible, push 75-year-old people over, right on their head, kill people. I mean, there's been over, 12 people that have been killed by police and National Guard so far. Some have been killed by vigilantes. And also you're seeing this kind of, take a knee, do a photo op type thing. Do you think that they will kind of continue down this counterinsurgency path, or there will be a reevaluation of what they're doing?
It's hard to know. First, let me say that the most visible response has been the clubbing and the tear gas and the running people over with cars. But it wasn't actually the first response. The first response to the video of George Floyd being killed was to just throw concessions at the problem. I mean, it was with astonishing speed that the FBI announced a civil rights investigation, that the police chief announced that the cops would be fired, that the district attorney announced that they were expecting to bring charges. Like, all of that happened within a few hours. Similarly, this is historically exceptional. Police chiefs and the leaders of police organizations all over the country were very fast to issue statements, either condemning the cops in the particular case or approving of the fact that they had been fired. Like, really, there was this race for people in police leadership to be seen as saying the right stuff about this. And also in the days following that, then, to be seen publicly calling for reforms. And some of that is this is significant in several ways. One is that the previous cycles of uprising, especially those after Ferguson, really changed the narrative. And it meant that they were now at the very beginning on the defensive and needing to respond to a narrative of police racism and the overall lack of legitimacy of the institution. So as opposed to, every other similar situation that I can think of where the general police approach has been to call for calm and urge people to wait till all the facts are in, or to immediately castigate the victim of police violence as a criminal and, cast the cops as heroes, etc. Right. So the urgency with which they wanted to be seen as saying the right things about race and calling for reform shows that previous riots had seriously changed the narrative about this. Secondly, it shows that they saw that they saw the likelihood of unrest here and were trying to get ahead of it. And were trying to get ahead of it by giving people the kinds of things that they ordinarily demand in hopes that that would placate the public and that people would view disruption as unnecessary. I think that kind of backfired, where what that did then was it took all the demands off the table and pushed the unrest outside of the discursive framework of demands and reforms, and instead just made a straightforward existential conflict. And then the third thing that it signifies that police leaders were in such a rush to be seen saying the right things about this is that they knew that some reforms were going to come out of this, and they wanted to get in early on the reform side so that they could have some say in how that unfolded. All of that fits in, broadly speaking, with sort of a counterinsurgency approach where the number one task is to establish legitimacy. All that having failed, the police fell back on their core function, which is, of course, hurting people and breaking things, is a problem for police leadership in that the violence is itself delegitimizing. And the more they use force to try to gain control, the more the legitimacy that in the long term their authority relies on diminishes. And so the worse the police violence gets on the street and the more people publicly see it, the harder it's going to be for them to reestablish their legitimacy. And, you know, as we've seen in the Minneapolis City Council, for example, has pretty much decided that the police just can't. They're just not going to be able to establish their legitimacy.
You think going into this thing, they knew, and I'm assuming because of everything else that was going on with the Ahmaud Arbery situation and everything else in the United States, you think going into this, they knew that this was going to blow open really big?
It could. I mean, to sound a little bit like a Marxist for a second, like, I think the objective conditions were just there, and that anyone who is looking to see if that was the case could see that they were. I mean, you know, there have been several high profile racist incidents in the last few weeks, and, there's the sort of economic outlook, which is objectively bleak. And then there's the sort of social psychological element of people having been cooped up and stir crazy and suffering anxiety about the pandemic for a couple of months. If you look at the world for a minute from the perspective of somebody like the Attorney General, like that has to be a very worrying combination of facts. And then to see this this particular incident, which had some unique features that made it, I think, especially likely to be a trigger. There's there's how much it resembles the Eric Garner case with the "I can't breathe" line, how much it resembles the Oscar Grant case with, you know, a handcuffed black man face down just being murdered, like on film. There's how much it resembles the Rodney King case where what is happening is just completely undeniable, right? There's no other story that can like justify it. And then there's the pure optics of that moment where, you know, the literal knee on the literal neck has itself such symbolic power that this particular case had to have clearly it did. It put everybody into like emergency mode right away, trying to do damage control on this and trying to like probably not even prevent unrest, but just contain, like just diminish it if they could. Yeah. So I think right away they were worried. And, you know, the events of the last couple of weeks have shown that they have every reason to be. And the cost to the legitimacy of the police has been severe. I mean, and not just among the public, but among other institutions where like schools and universities are canceling contracts to have police work security. Major corporations are like hustling to like put like Black Lives Matter banners on their websites and donate money to civil rights organizations. Like, and you know, some of that is probably sincerely meant and some of that is just straightforward cynical public relations, but in any case it shows that the trust in the police is at a low, maybe a historical low. Like I can't really think of another time in American history when policing has been looked at with such extensive scrutiny and so broadly distributed among the population.
Why do you think that is? Just because that they've, so many people are able to see the brutality and the violence and that they've been touched by it? I mean, is this like a wages of whiteness type thing where, you know, it's like a law of diminishing returns?
I mean, several things have changed. One element, and maybe the most obvious, is that the technology now exists that cop watching is not a specialized practice of small organized groups of people. It's a generalized tool of anyone who happens to have a phone in their pocket, which is everyone, right? and that it doesn't rely on, then the visibility of police brutality doesn't rely on the filter of the mainstream media can circulate very broadly on social media. So that's one element. So, you know, the reporting has in some sense gotten better. Another element is that, you know, these are the dividends of decades of very patient organizing and also periodic other unrest. I mean, it's been notable to me that every other uprising that, like every other sort of protest cycle around this that I've seen, sort of had to start at the beginning each time where, the police do something terrible. It is in some way documented and becomes publicly known, often by video. And then there's this initial stage at the beginning that has this argument of like, well, you know, there's a lot of mistrust of the police in certain communities. And then it ends with some sort of like, well, perhaps we need reforms or whatnot. The Ferguson cycle started at about the same place, but ended further on. It ended with, you know, respectable publications like Time Magazine running articles about police abolition. I'm not sure why, but for some reason, this cycle started where that one left off. So we didn't start with it turns out that there is mistrust of the police in certain communities. It started with the, hey, where are we on that abolition thing? I think some of the reason for this also is that in the period of mass incarceration, which began in the 1970s and only just leveled off in the last 10 years, the fact that there are a couple million people in prison means that there are a couple million people whose families are wishing that they weren't in prison. And it's not the same couple million over that entire 40-year period, right? So that means that there have been a lot of people really devastated by the criminal legal system. And I think that in the long term, that has had a very personalizing effect of what these institutions mean, what they're like. And, you know, while people of color are vastly overrepresented in the prison system, it operates at just such a scale that also means that millions and millions of white people have been through prison at this point, you know, far more than other comparable countries. And I think that that has made both the racial politics of the criminal legal system very apparent, but also has made it very relatable to white people who have had similar experiences, right? And historically, sort of the lower rungs of the white population have been a reserve from which the police have drawn when they needed auxiliary force. So the fact that disadvantaged white people are also suffering from the effects of the criminal legal system at a state that is unprecedented in their history, I think may have turned out to be a strategic mistake on the part of the state.
You're listening to It's Going Down, part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. If you value our work and want to support Revolutionary Autonomous Media, and you want to see this project grow, go to itsgoingdown.org/shop and sign up to donate monthly or give us a one-time donation. You can also follow us at itsgoingdown.org and at @IGD_news on Twitter. Let's get back to it. Let's talk about the take a knee stuff. Let's talk about the photo ops. I mean, does this surprise you at all? I mean, it seems like some people were really eating this up, and I know some people were like, no, don't, you know, don't drink the Kool-Aid. But I mean, there's just so many examples of, for instance, you know, one of the police officers that pushed over the 75-year-old Catholic worker guy in Buffalo, you know, 2 days before, I believe he was photographed, you know, taking a knee in a photo op. I'm just curious, how does this kind of play into what we're talking about when we talk about community policing or counterinsurgency?
Really, the only thing that surprises me about the taking the knee thing is how, like, transparently cynical it is. I mean, here in Portland, literally the cops took a knee and then fired tear gas, like, 3 minutes later. Like, it was like the news crews were still reporting on the taking the knee when the tear gas started flying, right? It's not especially, it, like, that particular gesture is, has a new currency. But really, if you look back at, like, the media coverage of any previous sets of uprisings, you can find the, pictures that get reprinted all the time and everybody loves of, like, the cop and the demonstrator hugging or, like, shaking hands or, like, whatever it is. And, you know, really the police are, at pains to try to present not necessarily to the demonstrators, but to the public that are witnessing it, the broader public, trying to present themselves as not being the enemies of sort of civil rights and social progress. There's this persistent effort for the police to sort of humanize themselves and to, you know, urge the public to like see them as individuals and that sort of thing, which on the one hand is very understandable from like an individual human level. And on the other hand, their authority isn't based on their individual virtue or character. Their authority is based on being part of this institution. And if the institution is racist, authoritarian, and inherently violent, it makes very little difference if some individual within it is, you know, somehow out of sync with that culture, right? Like the institution does far more to shape the behavior of the individual than the individual does to shape the behavior of the institution. I mean, anybody who has a job should know that.
There's lots of calls for campaigns to defund the police or remove them from certain campuses and stuff like that.
So it's interesting that defunding is the one sort of demand or reform which has managed to gain traction. Partly because it has, like, it's largely been a political non-starter for, you know, since the 70s, that the budgets of the rest of the city government shrink and the budgets of the police creep up. And it's interesting because, the types of reforms that the police themselves propose and that usually get rolled out in these sorts of situations tend to be reforms that are, intended to in some way improve the institution and, re-inscribe its legitimacy, to build public support, to improve public relations. And so they tend to focus on like better equipment, better training, things that at the end of the day bring more resources into policing and have the objective of ending up with like better policing. The thing that's interesting about defunding is that it is explicitly an effort to take resources out of policing, to put them other places, to allocate them other ways, to broaden how we think about public safety so that it isn't just like men with guns showing up and like locking people in cages. And it seems really kind of premised on a notion that, rather than pursuing better police, it is just pursuing less police, fewer police, less policing. So all of that seems good. I think a lot will depend though on the details of this. Like, if you're defunding the police, but you're putting those resources towards some other form of racist social control, then that's maybe not as good, right? And if the ultimate effect of defunding the police is that it allows the police to concentrate, you know, rather than being involved in like schools and parks and community centers and all of that sort of community policing stuff, if it allows them to just concentrate on like cracking heads in black neighborhoods, then that's also not the result we're looking for, right? So I think the details of this are, the details of the particular defunding efforts are really going to matter. That said, I think there's a lot of potential there to steer it in better directions rather than worse. It's something that we need to be, careful about and can't let ourselves become sort of intoxicated by the idea of what it could be that we forget to look at what it actually is.
Well, for instance, I saw one city that was like, you know, the police will no longer go to Israel and get, you know, training alongside the IDF, which, I mean, I'm assuming that's a positive thing.
Yeah, I think that's a win. How it's done and what comes after will very much matter. But the overall strategy of limiting their resources, reducing their weaponry, moving them out of the somewhat sacred position of being every local government's first priority. Like, I think all of that is very good.
My name John and I'm a city cop, and I'm just tired of these let me not. They try to paint me as racist, but see, I'm really not. Call me pork, so I put them on their belly at every stop. And they scared, what a joke. How about how I feel? Check the crime rate. Look at my eyes behind my shield. I'm scared. This is a job. This how I find my meal. So if they go and lie and steal, I'ma make them lie from steal. And I think my life do matter more. I seen too many of these people kill without remorse. Used to be three-fifths of a man, but I think half is more accurate. How they celebrate savageness in a patterned form. My family raised me not to trust them. Fuck you, they ain't wrong. These other cops are my brothers, and they be wishing us harm. They told me that it's our culture to make sure that they suffer, and I can't break the bond. It's all I got, I'm faithful, dog. Shit, I bleed blue like I'm a Giants fan. To question my ways, to stop flowing my veins. So I ain't slowing the day. I'ma keep everyone safe from these black bastards. And that's word to my gang, gang, gang.
I'm just riding for my gang, 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 gang.
Gang shit, America, whole lot of gang shit, America, whole lot of gang shit,
gang, 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 gang.
My name's James and I'm in the Klan. My family been down for a 4-generation span. It's not about the hatred, man. It's love for our nation, the white place. So we took savages and enslaved and tamed them. And these white threads, as hereditary as this white skin. I ain't have a say soon as I was of age, I was in. And if I have to, I resort to violence. Cause they try shine colors in a country made for white men. And we're poor too. Boo-hoo, all of you lefties complain about your oppression and pain. While all of these Mexicans came and take all our jobs and our lanes. And I don't blame corporatist games, cause I want the spoils and fame. I could have more too, that could be me one day. That's why I love Trump, cause see, he see my way. We gon' make America white again. Cause I don't wanna compete with people who work harder than me. Cause we all spited them. And if I consider that how we living is wrong, that would mean that I would have to concede that the sale and beating of those bodies was uncalled for. That it was all the murder and rape that got us these Sundays at the golf course. That we as heinous as they try to make us out to be, why would I even try? There's nothing in it for me to not treat it as a lie. So far as I'm concerned, all the blacks, Jews, and the gays, and the Muslims, and the Mexicans can leave or die. I do it all for the clan. These are my brothers. They understand me. We all understand each other. Don't tell me that our fathers and mothers should be ashamed. I'm riding out forever for my gang, 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 gang.
I'm just riding for my gang, gang, gang. Riding for my gang, 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 gang.
America, whole lot of gang shit. America, whole lot of gang shit. America, whole lot of gang shit.
Gang, 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 gang.
My name Marcus and I'm in the feds. I've been locked up for 4 years and 6 is left. I got 10 for armed robbery shit, and honestly, I ain't even wanna do it. And it's hard not to get depressed with dying here. Was banging colors since a youngin'. Was born into a gang cause of the block that I grew up in. I done seen many die and a few folks kill. But when the world won't give you nothing, shit, you gon' steal. And my gang was all I knew. Brothers amongst the madness, drugs and death all around us. And we was angry and callous. The gang shit was all we had. We made mistakes and were misled. But why my gang got me in jail? Yours got you home in bed. Riddle me that. My skin black, as simple as that. The hatred you both got for me is all written in fact. Of our institutions, you confused and feel like getting me back. For what? For living poor in conditions that's whack? You claim that I strike fear in you. But what you feel is you. For me to live how you call clean and be a miracle. The data is empirical. You hate it when my people march for me, but don't you too scream cause you feel they ain't hearing you. Shit, your whole premise is false, but I won't waste no time trying to break your prejudice walls. Point is, we all on some gang shit, loyal to what we taught, believing what was passed down, our community's theme of thought. And I'm the only one that cuffs for it. If I get out a better man, I'm still fucked for it. You turn the TV on and look, you got Trump for it. The president is in your gang, bitch, and you still pointing me to blame. Should I pray that when I get out, shit ain't all the same? But it's a cold world to be alone in when the whole place that you grown and treat you like dogs in the rain. Shit, I might fuck around and call gang, 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 gang.
I'm just riding for my gang, 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 gang. I'm just
shit. America, whole lot of gang shit. America, whole lot of gang shit.
Gang, 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 gang.
Let's say, for instance, all this momentum suddenly stops, which it doesn't appear at all. I mean, there's literally, as we're recording this, there's thousands of people in the streets in different cities, and there's different things going on. There's different campaigns. Also, there's, you know, local campaigns that are being developed. I mean, there's been people that have been shot and killed by the police in the U.S. just in the past couple of weeks while everybody's been out in the streets. I'm just curious, though, if people did stop, and the police were basically able to kind of take control of the situation, just to be pessimistic for a minute, I think it'd be very likely that what would come next out of this situation could be, you know, arguably even worse than what we have now.
This works at a couple different levels. In the immediate aftermath, and to some degree this is already beginning, like we have to expect intensified repression, right? That the police are going to be looking for the sort of social infrastructure that made this insurrection possible and trying to disrupt it. And, you know, opportunistically, like, pursuing other enemies as well, undoubtedly. Like, I don't think anybody who's responsible for administering repression actually believes that it is all an Antifa conspiracy, but I'm pretty sure that at the first opportunity, they will start moving against Antifa groups, because this will give them a good opportunity to do so. It won't stop there, of course. I mean, they'll look more seriously at the sort of social fabric of the Black community and where that can be disrupted. But, you know, just isn't it for, like, one thing that they've clearly signaled is that, we can expect repression against anti-fascists, like, the day this stops. In a broader sense, yeah, you know, there will be a period of, there will probably be a period where the police around the country seem to be doing a lot of different kinds of things, just kind of seeing what works in terms of how they respond to, you know, future scandals, future unrest, that sort of thing. It will seem a little unpredictable and helter-skelter for a while, and then it will probably solidify into a new model. I mean, we saw something similar with crowd control after the WTO protests in 99, where for a couple of years, it was very difficult to understand what the police thought that they were doing in any given instance, because they were trying so many different things in response to the anti-globalization movement and then the anti-war movement after that. And eventually that crystallized into a new strategy. We'll probably see something similar. We will probably see, we'll also certainly see some doubling down on things that they already know. So we'll see some efforts to entrench in the militarization, and we'll see some efforts to expand in the community policing kind of programs. Where that ultimately lands strategically, I think, is impossible to predict at this point. But you're right that there will be some very smart people with a lot of resources working very hard on this question. So, you know, for instance, I'm going to be paying attention to what the Rand Corporation has to say about this in the next couple of years. It will surely be something. But what exactly it will be, it's too early to tell.
There has just been such a kind of a good protest or bad protest or thing. Like, I've never seen an American president, you know, of course Trump is, you know, different than anybody else, but I mean, I've never seen them really try to single out, people like they have with this. And maybe this is just because, you know, this revolt is so big and it's different than anything else. But I'm just curious, you know, looking at, you know, the singling out of either, you know, anti-fascists or anarchists, how does that compare to other times in history? And also, like, again, this doesn't really seem to work also too. And it seems like the more that Trump kind of refers to and doubles down on kind of like mentioning and feeding off of like right-wing conspiracies, like, it seems like his bubble continues to shrink.
In other historical moments, the authorities have focused on, you know, particular groups, particular, like, boogeymen. Sometime in the 30s and sometime in the 70s, it was communists, right? People like J. Edgar Hoover were absolutely convinced that the American Civil Rights Movement was a communist conspiracy. And a lot of that was just his racist assumption that, like, there's no way that black people got up to this on their own, right? There must be a hidden hand here somewhere. And part of that was the just ambient paranoia of the Cold War. But interestingly, one of the things that really set Kitson and the counterinsurgency model apart from that is that it gave up on that conspiracy sort of thinking and instead was like looking at the features of the society that would produce the unrest and the populations indigenous to the society that would be participating in it. And while it was still important to identify and isolate the subversive element, the assumption was not that the response to inequality depended on outside agitators or some hidden conspiracy. Even by sort of authoritarian police state standards, Trump's thinking here is retrograde. However, there is a benefit that he gets by pushing this sort of conspiracy thinking and targeting like anarchists and Antifa and, you know, whatever, in that that speaks very clearly to the sort of lunatic right fringe that he is counting on for political support. And so, you know, we've seen the both terrifying and absurd spectacle of right-wing militias like mobilizing to guard tiny towns where, you know, probably nothing was going to happen at all. And if it was happening, it was a demonstration of a few dozen people who had no intention of like looting the post office or burning the only gas station in town, right? Like it managed to mobilize a legitimately dangerous element in opposition to an imaginary adversary. I think demonstrating his ability to speak to that element of society and potentially move them toward action, it cements, you know, his relationship with those groups. And then it also reminds the rest of us that the state is not the only actor in this, that the government is not the only source of violence that he can call on. And I wonder how much of that is calculating and how much of that is just his sort of shark-like predatory instinct. In terms of how that plays out in the less crazy part of the public discourse and the sort of good protester, bad protester, peaceful protest versus riot, all of that kind of stuff, that is exactly the model that solidified as a result of the anti-globalization movement. And a couple criminologists named John Noakes and Pat Gilham have done a very good job of articulating this as a theory called strategic incapacitation. And it relies on the police distinguishing between not violent versus nonviolent demonstrators, but compliant versus transgressive demonstrators. And so the trip line there isn't necessarily whether people in the demonstration are engaging in violence. It's whether people in the demonstration are being disobedient. And so if there's a demonstration which is like purely within the cops' confines and, you know, people show up, they walk on the sidewalk, they chant for an hour, they go home, then that's likely to get a certain kind of support and even praise from police officials. If there's a demonstration that breaks the rules, is disruptive of life overall, even if it's nonviolent, then that is going to get a more forceful response and be condemned as riotous and whatnot. One of the things that the Occupy movement got right is that it managed to overwhelmingly remain nonviolent and be transgressive, such that the police attacked it in a way that was delegitimizing for the police and legitimizing for the demonstration. So it was a clear echo of the strategy of the early civil rights movement. And that really revealed a shortcoming in this strategic incapacitation model. One of the things that I think is different about the present situation is that there's just something sort of empty about the cause for nonviolence in a situation where even just amassing groups of people together poses a risk to the health of everybody there and also everybody that they come in contact with. Just collecting people together already accepts a certain amount of risk to your own safety and practically guarantees harm to other people, really makes the sort of like the Gandhian position untenable. But then the question becomes like, okay, so are we going to engage in action which is just by collecting together, inherently dangerous and disruptive, or are we going to do nothing? And clearly, for, I think, at this point, hundreds of thousands of people around the country, doing nothing is not an option.
Well, we've been talking for a while now. Where can people follow your work?
I have a website. It's christianwilliams.com, Christian spelled with a K. And, you know, once a month or so, I post something about what I'm working on that month. But also, you can find links to other past articles that I've written. You can buy my books, find my email address, and send me hate mail.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.